Hello, I am Father C. John McCloskey, the director of the Catholic Information Center of the Archdiocese of Washington and a priest of the Prelature Opus Dei. Welcome to the first of our EWTN series dedicated to exploring the life, work, and thought of the Venerable Cardinal John Henry Newman as we approach the year 2000. Today's guest is Father Ian Carr, a priest of the Diocese of Portsmouth, England, a man who has his doctorate in English literature from the University of Cambridge in England, and is widely acknowledged as the foremost Newman scholar in the world. He's in numerous books that are available in print on Cardinal Newman, and it's a particular pleasure to have Father Carr with us today. We will be speaking during this show about an overall view of the life of John Henry Cardinal Newman, which was a long one. We're speaking about both his Anglican period leading up to his conversion to our Catholic faith and the tumultuous and interesting part of his life, which ended in 1890 as a Catholic. Father Ian, nice to have you here with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Could you give us, as a start, a little bit of an overview of what was the world in which John Henry Newman was born into in England in the early 19th century?
Well, Newman was born in 1801. It was, of course, the time of the Romantic period. It was at its heyday. There was also had taken place a huge evangelical revival, thanks to the Wesleys. And so the Church of England was in the throes of changing greatly. And of course, it was in less than 30 years' time the first great reform bill was to be passed. So we're also seeing the beginnings of what we would regard now as a modern modern society with a more democratic state, and a state, of course, in which the established Church of England was going to find itself in great difficulties in adjusting to this new situation.
Was Newman born into a strongly religious family, or was it middle class or nobility? Can you tell us a little bit about his family background?
Yes, he was born into, I suppose we would call, an upper middle class family. His father was a well-to-do banker, although the family had certainly no aristocratic roots, and his grandfather was quite a humble man. On his mother's side, Foudrinier, he came of French Huguenot stock. And especially as an old man, it's rather striking, the French look in his face. He looks rather like the late Cardinal Hume of Westminster, who also had a French mother. No, the family were very ordinary Church of England. They weren't particularly religious. They went to church. And it was a kind of Bible Protestantism, which I suppose has really almost ceased to exist in England today, and probably in Northern Europe. It was a non-sacramental religion. It wasn't a very dogmatic religion, but it certainly wasn't liberal Protestantism. But they were totally untouched by the evangelical revival.
Well, I think we certainly knew something about Bible Protestantism here in the United States,
yes.
Father Carr.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit also about in the early life of the Venerable John Henry, about the religious influences that played a part in his life and started to prepare him for the great work that was ahead?
Yes. Well, for some reason or other, when he was a small boy, he spent a lot of time with his aunt and his grandmother, and they perhaps were more religious than his own parents, and they instilled in him a great love of the Bible. And he had this extraordinary capacity to quote huge. He knew a lot of the Bible off by heart. And when he became a Catholic priest, he used to take into the pulpit a Dawe version of the Bible, sometimes, I think, to check quotations sometimes, for fear that he might quote from the authorized version, or what you call in America the King James version, which of course in those days would have been considered a very heretical sort of thing to do. Mm-hmm. But he just knew huge chunks. So that was the first big influence, was that he was absolutely steeped in the scriptures. And then the next big event took place when he was 15 years old, in adolescence, like so many of his contemporaries, George Eliot, the novelist, for instance. In his adolescence, he underwent some kind of an evangelical conversion, and as a result, influence of a school teacher. So that was the second big step. And then the next big step, of course, came when he went on to Oxford.
Well, since we're going in a linear progression, perhaps we continue along those lines. We know that he went to school in England, and he went up to Oxford, as they say, at a fairly young age.
He was only 16, yes, which was early, a year or two earlier than would normally have been the case. But he had had phenomenal success at school. I mean, he was undoubtedly considered the most brilliant student they'd had at the school.
And when he was at Oxford, what did he study? What college was he associated with at the university?
Well, he was an undergraduate at Trinity College, as was common in those days. So it was in Oxford where there was very few, the only real faculties in terms of subjects being taught really were classics and mathematics. Those were really the only two subjects on offer. Theology was at a very low ebb indeed, and you certainly couldn't read for a degree in theology in those days, or in English literature or modern languages. And he did a double degree in classics and mathematics.
And it is
and did very poorly. So if he's declared, if he's canonized, I hope, I'm sure he will be, perhaps he could become the patron saint of people who do badly in their examinations.
We'll probably explore this as our programs go on, but he was a man of a very nervous temperament, we could say, in some ways, and who had a tendency at times to overwork, a man of great energy. Wasn't the fact that he did poorly in his exams had something to do with a physical or mental exhaustion?
Yes, I mean, it was. It wasn't that he was badly prepared or anything, or not. It was simply that he had overworked, as you say, and he had a kind of nervous collapse, or a sort of semi-breakdown, I suppose.
Now, he recovered from that collapse in part by achieving what was really one of the great moments of his life, which I believe was his being made a fellow of Oriel College. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the background of Oriel and what it meant for him from that point on to have achieved that status.
Well, Oxford, you see, one has to remember that England at this point in time was still an Anglican country. It was, the established church was a huge force in the land, a great political power, great wealth, and Oxford was the center of the Anglican church, really. And so it was the religious and also the intellectual center of the country. And Oriel was the most prestigious of the colleges. So in being elected a fellow of Oriel, he was right in the very heart of the academic and religious establishment. So to get a fellowship at Oriel was I mean, I don't know what the American equivalent would be, but it was he couldn't have done better.
He would essentially as a chaired professor, or similar to having tenure, but a more exalted position.
Yes,
than
but
that.
With also you see this political in this access to political power as well.
Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, he, as he was a fellow at Oriel, he was also acting as a tutor, a position that you yourself hold at Campion Hall in Oxford. What I know there was a certain controversy in the way he approached the idea of being a tutor, that it simply wasn't a question of academic, but also that he felt a certain responsibility for the moral growth of the people that were under his tutorship.
Yes, well, it's an interesting question. Thank you for asking that question. I mean, it's interesting that Oxford at the time, the way the teaching was done was very similar to that in the United States today in a small liberal arts college. Mm-hmm. It was taught in small classes of 15 or 20 students. The tutorial system, which Oxford is now, or Britain is famous for, had not really been developed at that point. Mm-hmm. Tutorials were entirely something done privately, really on the side. What Newman wanted to do was to have much greater, as you say, it was an Anglican university. He was in holy orders, and so he wanted to have a moral and religious influence on his students. But he also felt, and this was very, of course, essential to his educational vision, was this business of personal influence and a personal interaction between the student and the teacher. And so he could say that, I think it's true to say, that he really pioneered the tutorial system as we now have it in Oxbridge. But he fell foul of the authorities in doing this. The provost of the college was not at all favorable to the idea. And so he was effectively dismissed.
That was Mr. Hawkins, was it not?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's one of those great providential events in church history, because it was a result of the dismissal from his teaching duties that he was able to stay on in those marvelous days as a fellow, not as much salary as he'd had when he was a tutor, but stay on in the college, and it enabled him to become a sort of full-time, as we would say, a full-time research scholar. Although he did have pastoral responsibility, he was vicar of the university church, but there wasn't a large resident parish or anything. It was mainly for dons and undergraduates. But it enabled him to begin those hugely important researches into the fathers, and particularly the Greek fathers.
Now, you've established a parallel vision of Newman at this point. One part, he was an academic researcher, and evidently he read almost all the fathers of the church in their original language.
He began reading systematically. Right from the beginning, from the apostolic fathers.
At the same time, he was the vicar of St. Mary's Church in Oxford?
He was, by this point, vicar of St. Mary's, the university church. which had an important position in the university, where the university sermons were preached, for example. Mm-hmm. I should mention, because you asked me about the influence, Newman confessed in his theological autobiography, the Apologia Pro Vita Sua, that he was drifting dangerously in the direction of liberalism. So you could say here there was a third point in Newman's career, a third influence here, coming in from what today I suppose we would call liberal Protestantism, because some of the leading figures at Oriel, who were in holy orders, were the beginnings, really, of the new liberal Anglican school of theology. And Newman did fall under that influence. And he used to say it was the fathers who saved him. So we have another influence there. We start with Bible Protestantism, then we have Evangelicalism, which he comes to be disillusioned with for various reasons. Then he has this fairly short flirtation with liberalism, but I think it did leave an imprint on him. He never lost his sense of the huge importance of theology. And then now comes the next big influence, which is the fathers, and particularly the Greek fathers, much more than the Latin fathers. The Latin fathers weren't nearly so important for him.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we are trying to do a rapid survey of a very long life,
yes.
At a certain point along, or maybe perhaps not at a certain point, but he certainly, as he grew in erudition and also in holiness and effectiveness in terms of the personal influence, became the beginnings of what was known as the Oxford movement, in which people like Keble or Pusey were involved and others. And he started to get a certain type of group around him. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about the Oxford movement and its beginnings.
Yes, well, I said just now that it was a providential event, the fact that he was fired as a tutor. Well, it's providential, as I said, because it enabled him to study the fathers. And of course, it was the study of the fathers that was at the basis of the Oxford movement. The Oxford movement, Newman used to say, began with John Keble's so-called Assize Sermon. It was a particular sermon that was preached annually when the Crown Court came to Oxford.
What year was that, Father Coran?
This is 1833. And of course, one of the great paradoxes, because it was the British government trying to do something for the poor Irish Catholics and also Irish Presbyterians. Because one has to remember at this point in time that in Ireland, the Church of Ireland, the Anglican Church of Ireland, was the established church there. A tiny minority of the population belonged to it, but the rest of the population had to support it. There was a tithing system. And so the British government, not out of any love for either Catholics or Presbyterians in Ireland, but for real fear of civil war, decided that the church had to be cut down a bit. And so they decided to suppress some of the sees, and various other measures were taken. But for somebody like Keble, a high churchman like Keble, the dangers implicit in this were very threatening indeed, because it meant the state could interfere in the church. And so Keble's sermon was denouncing the state interference. Now, the reason why Newman said that this was the beginning of the Oxford movement was because it forced people like Keble and Newman and their friends to start reflecting on the fundamental question, what is the church? Because, of course, for many people in England at the time, the Church of England was simply a department of the state. It was a spiritual department of the state.
Which is known as Erastianism?
Erastianism. Mm-hmm. But Keble, coming from a high church tradition, of course, couldn't accept that. So then the question came, arose, that they're under political pressure of the Reform Bill, arose, well, what is the church? What is the nature of the church? And so essentially what the Oxford movement did was to go back to the fathers and say, well, what do the fathers say it is? We've all got the New Testament, whatever our views, evangelicals, mm-hmm. liberal Protestants, Roman Catholics, whatever. But so let's go back to the fathers and see what they thought about the church. I mean, how did they view Christianity?
Well, we've gotten a good overview of Newman right up to, let's say, 1840. Happily, in other programs, we're going to examine more in detail both the Oxford movement and the moment of his conversion. Perhaps we could go from 1845, was that the year that Cardinal Newman...
That's the year of conversion.
His conversion. Perhaps you tell us a little bit about what happened after his conversion in terms of his time in Rome and the discernment that the particular religious life that he chose would be the oratory.
Right. Yes, he went to Rome in 1846 to study at the College of Propaganda, now what's now the Università Urbaniana. It wasn't the top university in Rome, which was then the Collegio, perhaps still is, the Collegio Romano, you might not agree with this, or what's now called the Gregorian University. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know if there's any other instance in the history of the church, or was History of the World, whereby a student finds his own book being commented on critically at the top flight university while he's attending as a student the third-rate university in the city. But that, of course, is what happened, because Newman's essay on the development of Christian doctrine, which was the key book, I mean, where he finally makes up his mind to become a Catholic. And the book, thanks, I'm sorry to say, to an American called Orestes Branson, who had converted from Unitarianism in Boston and thought this whole idea of the development of doctrine was playing into the hands of the Unitarians. So he denounced the book very vociferously, and this reached the ears of the Roman authorities. And so theologians of the Gregorian, the Collegio Romano, were talking about the book in their lectures.
And after he finished his education there, was ordained a Catholic priest in, was it 1847, believe. At that point, he made the choice, along with some of his other followers who were studying with him in Rome, in order to become an oratorian. I know you're very familiar with the oratory. Maybe you could tell briefly something about that.
Well, he looked at various forms of religious life and rejected them for various reasons. Several things that attracted him about the oratory. First of all, he had this community at Littlemore, this village outside Oxford, where he and his companions had gone into this sort of lengthy retreat to consider their future in the Church of England. And so he was responsible, in a way, for these people. And so he wanted to stay with them. And the oratory provided the opportunity for that. The oratory of St. Philip Neri is essentially a community of secular priests living according to a rule. And so if he had joined an order, they would have been dispersed, he and his companions, even if they joined the same order. So that was one thing that attracted him. The second thing I think attracted him was, of course, by this point he was 45 by the time he was doing 46.
Which is quite old for those days.
Quite old, you see. And it would have meant that he'd have to sort of start all over again in a religious order, and he'd have to have an... And, you know, I think he felt that he already had his own, that he was his own man, as it were. What he had to offer the church was already there, you know, and that therefore it was important that he should, I think, be true to himself. After all, Wiseman, the future Cardinal Wiseman, had told him not to change the essay on the development of Christian doctrine. And simply publish it as he had written it as an Anglican, although it was being published as by this time point he was a Catholic. I think the other thing about the oratory which attracted him greatly was the possibility of combining academic and pastoral work, you see, because that, after all, what he'd done at Oxford. I don't think Newman would have ever been happy. In that way, it's a parallel with Hans Urs von Balthasar. I don't think Newman would have ever been happy simply in an academic position, really. He always wanted this combination. Mm. And the oratory provided that possibility, that he could continue to write books, but that he'd also have pastoral possibilities.
Now, the Catholic part of his life, once he returned to England, established the oratory in London and in Birmingham, certainly was not a tranquil life by any stretch of the imagination, quite the contrary. Perhaps you could fast forward to some of the controversies that marked the rest of his life, right up in, at least until, I guess, the last 10 years of his life. Maybe we could, for a moment, refer to the question of the attack by Kingsley and his writing of the Apologia pro Vita Sua.
Well, we come to another very providential event in Newman's life, because he really felt, he said he felt great gratitude, really, to Kingsley. By this point, we're talking now about 1864, at this point, the Ultramontanism was in full tide in the church.
Maybe you could define Ultramontanism briefly for our viewers.
Well, yes, I think you can correct me, Father McCloskey, if I'm wrong, but I think Ultramontanism comes from the Latin words ultramontes, and it began, as you might call, a sort of liberal Catholic movement in France, as the movement being one to appeal across the Alps, across the mountains to Rome, in order to achieve the independence of the local church from state control. The French were confronted, faced with the Gallican church. But then increasingly the movement of Ultramontanism became an appeal to Rome as a centralizing authority. And this became, and in England, especially among many of the Newman's converts, became very much the cause they espoused. And Newman was never entirely happy with that. And there were a number of misunderstandings, not least over a famous article of his on Consulting the Faithful in Matters of Doctrine, which he published in, I think, 1859. I hope that's the right date. Mm-hmm. And that got him into a lot of trouble, unfortunately, with the authorities in Rome. And there was a kind of a cloud over him. And when Kingsley launched this vituperative attack upon him, Kingsley was a well-known novelist. He was had the chair of modern history at Cambridge. He's a very well-known figure.
The propagator of muscular Christianity.
Yes. A sort of liberal Protestantism, but a very muscular liberal Protestantism. And Newman realized that this was a marvelous moment for him to vindicate his life, both against his Catholic critics, who accused him of being a semi-Protestant, and against his former co-religionists, many of whom really did think that he'd been a Catholic all along, that he'd been a Jesuit spy within the Church of England. Because you have to imagine, I mean, I suppose the equivalent in America would be a very, very prominent American at the height of the McCarthy era deciding to become a communist. I mean, it's a bit like that, because you have to remember that in England at the time, to be a Roman Catholic was not only to adopt a religion which was considered backward and superstitious, but was also considered an unpatriotic thing, because after all, the church, England had defined itself so much in terms of the split from the continent and the peculiar English Reformation, whereby the Church of England became the state church with the king at its head.
Mm-hmm. So in a certain sense, at this point, Newman took on a whole other figure in England. That is, he was much more respected. In a certain sense, he was vindicated.
Yeah, as a result of publishing the Apologia Pro Vita Sua, which was defense of his life, mm-hmm. ostensibly against Kingsley, the Ultramontanes realized that they had to be very careful before attacking him too openly. Mm-hmm. And of course, so many of his former co-religionists and the ordinary English public began to realize that he had been sincere all along, however mistaken he might have been, that he was entirely sincere.
Now, while all this was going on, perhaps you just for a moment you could tell us about the pastoral work he was doing in Birmingham, a place that he chose precisely in part because it was not London, in order
yes.
to do more humble work with souls.
Well, of course, when he started in Birmingham at Ulster Street down in the city centre, we would have to imagine it would really be third world conditions. It would be like you going to a slum parish in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
There were the vast numbers of Irish immigrants pouring into the industrialised cities of Victorian England. And those are the people he was dealing with. And they were exactly the sort of people we would find in the third world today. And here was this educated Oxford Don doing pastoral work among them. That's how he began life in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm. We've skipped over for the moment his foundation of the college in Dublin. We do not have time to go into it in this program, although we will in another. But he had various other controversies and great disappointments during his life. He wanted to establish an oratory, did he not, or at least some type of chaplaincy at Oxford?
Yes, he wanted to establish an oratory in Dublin because when he founded the Catholic University of Ireland, that never came off.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, the university problems, very serious problems there. Yes, later on he wanted to establish an oratory in Oxford. At this point, there was a ban on Catholics attending Oxford and Cambridge, introduced by the hierarchy, for fear that they might lose their faith. And this is very much under the ultramontane influence of people like Cardinal Manning. And Newman thought this was a very short-sighted policy, that since there was no Catholic university in England, since the Irish university had never really taken off and English Catholics weren't really prepared to go there, it was inevitable they would have to attend British universities, and therefore it was a short-sighted policy simply to issue a ban, which of course was very often ignored or evaded. And so it was much better to accept the situation for what it was and establish a strong Catholic chaplaincy there.
Some people consider one of the great losses of English literature and liturgy would have been the possible translation of the Bible by John Henry Newman. There was some talk about that, and some of us who love the prose of the Venerable John Henry just think of the idea of a Newman Bible, and what a delight that would be today. What was the story on that?
Well, the story was that the English hierarchy commissioned him to do this translation. He was going to have helpers, and he began work. And another wonderful providential event, actually, in spite of what you say, is I think it would have killed him, and of course it would have prevented him from writing so many important books. Well, fortunately, it was the Americans who intervened, in the sense that he heard that it was Archbishop Kenrick, wasn't it, of Baltimore, had decided to bring out a translation. And so, of course, Newman said, well, you know, I can't be in rivalry, we've got to come to an arrangement. And he never got any reply from the English bishops, who simply dropped the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So although I quite see your point about how lovely had a Bible from Newman, I think it nevertheless was a providential event, because otherwise it would have taken the rest of his life probably.
If there was one book that you would recommend for our viewers to get hold of in order to learn more about Cardinal Newman, either by reading him or by an author, could you recommend us one, including one of your own?
No. Well, I'm tempted to say to recommend a book that many Newman scholars have never read, and that is Newman's novel Callista, which is a delightful novel. So it's a very pleasant read. It's available in paperback, I think, in the United States.
Yes,
still.
It is.
and not, I'm sorry to say, in England, I don't think. And it's a delightful story, but it also brings out some of Newman's very profound philosophical and theological ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very good introduction to his spirituality, too.
That was written as part of a series, and many of our viewers probably have read or heard about the book Fabiola by Cardinal Wiseman.
Yes.
In fact, we have an expert on Cardinal Wiseman coming up in a show later on. So it almost has to do with the 2nd century Catholicism, another with 3rd century Catholicism.
Yes, Newman's was concerned with 3rd century Catholicism in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the idea was to set up a library, a sort of library of novels. It was very much the vogue at the time. Mm-hmm. Anglo-Catholics were doing it, evangelicals were doing it. Mm-hmm. These historical novels, which of course were intended to have apologetic force to them.
Cardinal Newman died a holy death, did he not?
He died, yes, I think a holy death. He died in 1890 of pneumonia. Mm-hmm. He was then in his 89th year. He didn't quite reach his 90th birthday.
Mm-hmm. Well, we look forward to having you back again, Father Carr, for another 2 or 3 programs on various subjects. And thank you so much for being here today, because you've given us a very nice overview, and not an easy thing to do with a person who lived to be 89 years old, both the Anglican and the Catholic life of Cardinal Newman. And also want to thank all the viewers who've been with us for this first episode of Cardinal Newman at the year 2000. We look forward to having you with us in the future and to having an opportunity to go deeper into the person, the thought, and the work of the Venerable John Henry Newman.